brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Okay, Mark, welcome back to the podcast. Tell us all about sitting in Bugman's with a pint of beer, opening your Marauder Giant. This is a childhood dream of yours, I'd assume, you know, the whole drinking a pint part.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it was really cool, actually. I pre-ordered the Marauder Giant whenever that went up for order a month or two ago. And then you could have it paid to have it delivered to your house, or you could pick it up from a GW store. I was like, oh, pick it up from a store, that'll be free, I'll do that. And I realized as I clicked the list, it had Warhammer World at the top of the list. And I thought, oh, I've never thought of that. And it sort of all collided, really. I was like, do you know what? I'm going to combine that with, I was already going over to the Partisan show in May. And I was thinking, do you know what? If I can make all this happen, I'll go to the show and then I'll go to Warhammer World. I'll have a look around. Also, Rowan, who is in our Discord community, very kindly sent me an entrance ticket for the Warhammer World Museum. So I had that. And it just, I thought, brilliant. I'll go to Partisan. I'll go to Warhammer World. I'll look around the museum. I'll pick up the Marauder Giant and I'll go to Bugman's. And yeah, it was super cool, actually. It didn't disappoint whatsoever. And all the people in the Warhammer World place were all like really friendly and like really kind of thought it was really cool that I was getting the Marauder Giant. They weren't sort of, oh, if you're not playing the new games, you know, we don't want to talk to you. It was none of that. It was really, really good, actually. And yeah, just opening that massive metal model in that really cool Bugman's pub was, it was a really, really cool moment, actually. And, still amazed by how good quality that model was, and just looking at it and thinking, wow, someone's hand sculpted this. But what was even cooler is about an hour and a half before that, Ali Morrison, who sculpted it, was stood, you know, like two people away from me at Partisan talking to Dave Andrews about the game that he was playing. And then I was opening up this Ali Morrison Giant and then went and looked at Dave Andrews' amazing diorama, the jousting one. And you know, it's quite a surreal moment, really. All these people who were in White Dwarf when you were a kid and this model you wanted to buy when you were a kid. And then suddenly, you know, this middle-aged man experiencing it all kind of coming back around full circle. It was a very cool moment indeed. The beer wasn't particularly amazing, though. It was some kind of Golden Space Marine special. It was all right.
Just some sort of pissy, weak lager.
Yeah, it was. It was just clearly just a can of Foster's that then they decant into the thing or something and then charge like £9 for it. I had a half as well, and it came in this tiny little mug. Yeah, it was quite cool.
A quarter.
It was quite funny. I just pretended I was a Marauder Giant with this minute mug.
A barrel. What was the packaging of the Giant like? I'm assuming they didn't put it in like a... I mean, I'm assuming that thing never came in a blister pack originally anyway, because it'd be quite big, but...
It's sort of like a blister, like a double type blister, so a bit bigger with like half of the bits in each of the trays, and then it's in a cardboard box, but the cardboard box is just like a generic branded Warhammer branding, and it's got just got their sort of like black and white artwork for some of their modern stuff on it. So, and I bought a Green Knight from them as well, and that came in the same type of thing. So I think it's just like the generic box for stuff that hasn't got artwork on. So it was it would have been really cool if it had had the artwork. And I thought they might have done it, but again, it's production cost and, you know, they kind of haven't bothered with that. But no, it was still cool that it was actually in a box and opening it up, and still weighs loads. It's a really cool thing.
How much was the Giant, if you don't mind me asking?
It was 50 quid, which actually it's a chunk of money, obviously. But I think it was... I think I look back, I can't remember exactly what I looked up. I think when it came out, it was about 15 quid or 20 quid. It was that kind of money. So yeah. 50's not bad. It's probably fair.
I'm surprised. I expected like three times that, to be honest.
Yeah. They could have charged more and they haven't. I don't know why. And it's pretty good. The secondhand market ones are still really expensive, you know, eBay ones and stuff like that. But the only thing that they have done is it appears they opened up a window, produced some, and then closed the window again. So I was lucky to get in at the point they went live and got one. I know not everyone's been so lucky. But yeah, price-wise, I think that was fair. And the Green Knight that I bought was 25 quid. Again, that would have been probably 10 quid when it came out, 15 quid. It all feels like it's, yeah, they're not, they can't be making a bucket load of money on it.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep up with, because I know that they do, you know, limited runs on stuff like this and models for the past, like how do you sort of keep up with that, if at all?
So only, it's mainly through people putting it on Josh's Crown of Command Discord. There's a GW made to order channel that he's created on there. And I just popped in there and had a look in there. And people were talking about it. Ted, who's on our Discord and on Josh's as well, has been really on it and kind of like letting people know when things are going up and live. So that's been really helpful because I haven't really, I've not been keeping up with GW for ages, so I wouldn't really know. And their website's a bit weird, it's quite hard to navigate. It seems a bit strange, it seems a bit hard to try and work out where stuff would be. But yeah, they publish, I think, on like a Sunday night what they're going to put available for pre-order the next Saturday, I think, every week. And they've occasionally done these pre-orders for the old world stuff and, you know, bringing back the old models. So it kind of happened in a bit of a flurry, but when they did the Giant, they also did the River Trolls and the stone Trolls and some other stuff as well. So it kind of all happens in a bit of a bundle, as far as I can tell. But this, I mean, if it's selling well and people are appreciating it, then hopefully that means they're going to also do some of the other kind of classic things like, you know, Empire steam tanks and war wagons. And they're the things I think people would really like to see and are kind of worth the money, if you like, because they were always, especially for our generation, they were the things that you actually couldn't really afford when you were into the hobby. Because they were that bit more money and it was like, well, I could buy a game for that or whatever it might be or best part of. So they were probably the things that didn't really ever get bought. So yeah, that they're on my wish list a little bit more than anything else.
Yeah, Snotland Pump Wagon. Like if they did that, I would get one for my Jarrus Warband.
Yeah, I think they have done one, but I think if it's a more recent one, so it's like perhaps one from a later edition of Warhammer, I think. I don't really know, but I'm kind of pretty much only interested in like the sort of fourth and fifth edition type Hero Hammer stuff, to be honest.
Yeah, because big lump of metal.
The only reason is just the big lump of metal, the sort of cheeky grins and the silly kind of sculpting stuff. Like I like that. That cut slightly cartoonish aesthetic, just because it's what I remember really more than anything else. Whereas I think some of the stuff that's from later Warhammer seems a bit more, I don't know, just doesn't really kind of go with the same style. It's a different thing. So some of the old world armies are therefore a bit of a mixture of sort of newer and older things. I mean, it's still all old. Even the newer things are from like 2005 or whatever, so they're not recent. But yeah, it's definitely a different look.
There is a satisfaction with the massive lumps of metal, isn't there? Like I would love to see one of the early Great Unclean ones because I never held one, but apparently they were like proper bowling balls. So
yeah, they would be. And if they, I don't really know how it works, but something to do with the fact that the old world game is set, I don't really understand this, but it's set, you know, before when Warhammer was set, when we played it. And so it's like before Chaos came or something like that. So I think that the Chaos and the Skaven armies and stuff aren't in it or something. So I don't know whether that will limit them to release it. But with Chaos being such a big, big part of their brand, you know, it feels like they're missing a trick by not doing so. But then maybe they just want people to buy the modern Chaos stuff. I'm not really sure. But yeah, those metal Great Unclean ones are massive looking.
Yeah.
It's like a sort of fist of pure metal, isn't it?
Had you been to Warhammer World before then?
No, I hadn't actually. And I'd always toyed with it and never been. And you did your little report back when you went a couple of years ago, was that?
Yeah.
And that, you know, enthused me. I was like, oh, I must go. And although I was kind of, and I was pleased that I'd heard your episode and your report back about the fact that it wasn't quite the museum per se. It was a bit more of a showcase, and it didn't have that kind of chronological structure to it in a way that it could have done as a visitor centre. Although I'm kind of pleased that I had that in mind, because that probably slightly lowered my expectations, and I was pleasantly surprised when I went by how good it was. Mm-hmm. But also kind of how they had just really cool things, like even in the entrance lobby, they got a copy of I think it was like a requisition or like a purchase order or something like that for Games Workshop for someone who wanted to buy 6 Mancala sets, you know, 6 wooden boards. And it was like really cool, just the fact they've got these old artifacts in there. And I don't know, sort of my impression of their company is that they kind of turn their back on their heritage perhaps. And maybe that was a bit unfair, because there was plenty at Warhammer World that was, you know, honouring their heritage and was interesting, and looking back fondly, it was really good. But it's also kind of like 40th year and 500th anniversary edition of White Dwarf and all that kind of stuff. So maybe they're in nostalgia mood. Nostalgia certainly sells, so I don't blame them.
So you were at, were you at Warhammer World after Partizan, or was it the other way around?
The other way around. So yeah, I think, so Partizan was on like 10 till, I got there at 10 and I left at about 3. And then I went to Warhammer World on the way back, because that was open till 6 for some reason. So that was quite good. So it was able to combine it all in, and it was, you know, it was literally on the route for me as well. So there was no detour. So it was really cool, and I'm really glad to go over and just sort of be able to spend the time there. What was also quite interesting is there was clearly a, I think it must have been like an Age of Sigmar tournament or something going on in the gaming hall. And it was just really fascinating to see. It was just sort of what it looked like and how it was. And it was just like, because it was this hive of activity in there. It was quite good, actually. It was definitely, I would recommend anyone to go over for a visit if you're on the way. But I'm kind of wondering about whether to go back at some point. But at the same time, I think it's one of those places where I presume that they don't change the displays particularly frequently, but it's pretty spectacular, the stuff.
Did they have that thing where you have to find a miniature? There's like the huge diorama, and they were running a like competition when we were there. So they were like, can you spot this guy? And I didn't even recognize the miniature, so I had no chance.
I think because I was there on a Sunday afternoon, they didn't mention it to me, and I went in with a ticket that had been gifted to me. So they didn't say about it to me, and I knew they'd said about it to you, but it was still part of it that you could look for these things. But yeah, the thing with the dioramas, they're really good, but some of the more modern ones, I don't know whether it's partly as well the kind of real grimdark aesthetic. I find it a little bit hard to. I think I'd prefer to see stuff where it's really obviously, you know, here's a bright green grassy field and individual models on their little square bases, whereas it's a lot more diorama-y and it's a lot more cinematic looking, isn't it? The stuff that they've got there. It looks really cool, but it sort of slightly blurs into one.
Yeah.
And because I've been out at a game show anyway with loads of stuff on show, I don't know. It just kind of probably was a little bit snowblind to it all. And I'd walk around just mainly trying to focus on finding the old stuff that I could find, really. And I was probably a little bit blind to some of the newer things, but it's still, you can't deny it's really spectacular.
So what about Partizan? I had a wee look, and we had a chat on the podcast pretty much this time last year about Partizan 23.
Yeah.
So this your second year in a row going to that?
I was really glad I did, actually, because just sort of in about a week or 2 weeks before it, I thought to myself, do you know what? It's perhaps going to be pretty similar to the experience last year. I don't know, you know, should I bother going or not? And I've kind of just half wondered if it was just a bit of a faff to go, really. But I was really glad I did, because essentially every game was completely unique, and you know, it was all new stuff. So the people who are the same people who had put on demonstration games and display games last year brought new ones this year. So you just think, wow, this is kind of like, must be almost like the heartbeat of their club or their cycle or whatever, building up all this new stuff to bring along. And just some of the things, I mean, it's mainly historical, but they've got a lot of stuff that's Certainly where it's historical, they'll have things that are like what if scenarios, and they'll have like, you know, there's a big Indiana Jones theme board with like, you know, Nazis and temples and all this kind of stuff. So it's got that kind of pulpy feel to it as well. But there's a lot of fantasy and a lot of sci-fi there as well. It's just really cool, the sort of buzzy atmosphere. And the other thing with it that's, I don't know, it's a little bit weird, really. It's just how many XGW people are just there milling about. So, you know, Perry Brothers and, like I say, Ali Morrison, Dave Andrews. Who else was there? Rick Priestley was there. John Stallard was there. And it was, you know, just people just sort of milling about that you recognise out of White Dwarf magazines. And I don't know, it's just quite cool. It's obviously just a real community meet point where these people decide to get together and all go along. And, you know, just I think it creates something where sort of, even though I was just walking around and just chatting to a few people and just kind of mostly just observing it, really, you feel like you're part of a bigger community. And, you know, you're not necessarily going to appreciate everything that everyone likes there, but there's just so much. Everything's got something in common, which is all about that thing that draws me to tabletop miniatures games over, say, video games or board games or card games or whatever it might be. And it's that visual spectacle of bringing the miniatures, the terrain, the people, the social atmosphere, all that stuff together. It's quite hard to capture, really. I imagine if you're into cars or whatever it might be, you want to go to a big motor show and see all these things together and actually sort of go up and smell them and touch them and feel them and be there. Because it's such a visual, visceral kind of hobby that to be able to really experience it like kind of at hand rather than just through photos is a really cool experience, actually. And also, I think the other thing that I enjoy as well is just browsing all the stalls, looking at the traders, seeing what stuff people have got on offer. I didn't really buy very much, but it's just cool just to see what's there, really, and all the companies you've never heard of and the game systems and the settings that you've never considered playing games in. It, you know, it's really inspiring. And yeah, I'm really pleased I went. Definitely go again.
Yeah, that's cool to hear about, like, you know, Rick Priestley, Ali Morrison and all these folks just milling about as well. And it gets you thinking that we do live in quite a unique time where, you know, that it wasn't a short time ago that they were involved in really growing the company to what it is, you know, and a huge part of everyone's childhood. And they're still around today. I know we lost Brian Ansell last year, but there's still more chance than not that you go to these events and see these folks milling about. And it won't always be that way, like, not to be moribund, but, you know, everyone gets older and older and there'll come a day where that isn't the case. So it is this unique time, isn't it, where, you know, that these people are legends and you are able to just access them. And it's something I hope, not in a bad way, but it's something I hope folk take advantage of, you know, at least get the chance to speak to one or two of their heroes at some point in the next few years.
Yeah, and they seem very available now and very, because I think a lot of them are reaching sort of, you know, sort of either the ends of their careers or retirement and so forth. So they're willingly giving their time. There's people on YouTube who are doing interviews with them and there's podcast appearances and they're going to things like this. I feel like they're sort of, they are very much, and they're putting out, you know, things like the obviously there was the Dice Men book and then the Talking Miniatures book. There's this kind of sense of giving back a bit to the community and doing that. It feels like that's a really good opportunity to kind of really celebrate. It's almost like, you know, there was a kind of probably a bit of a golden age of wargaming when it first came about that inspired these guys. And then they in turn then were kind of had a renaissance in the 90s through Warhammer and the GW games. And, you know, then they've gone back to perhaps their roots in historical gaming, a lot of them, in terms of their interests. But what it's done is it's kind of created then, hopefully there'll be like a third wave of people who are their prodigies, who come through and start, you know, really carving out a unique space and doing things in a different way. Because some of the stuff, some of the rule systems, some of the miniatures, some of the terrain and all of the different kind of elements of the hobby, although they've developed since the 1990s and they've come on in different ways, there's still a lot of reference points that go back to that GW kind of what I see as a kind of golden era. And I know that's partly nostalgic because it meant a lot to me as a kid. But at the same time, I do feel like, you know, you look at things now and there's sort of no greater praise for a lot of things than when people say, oh, this is just like something from Warhammer from 1994 or whatever it might be. That feels like a, and you know, these people who were involved in that, it just felt like it was probably a real coming together of minds and creative enterprise. And it did create that kind of almost Renaissance period, I would have thought, with just so many enthusiastic creative people just pooling the resources, and the legacy they've created is pretty amazing.
It makes you think too that, again, not following the company too closely, so I could always be slightly wrong on these matters, but you know, they don't really tell you much about their staff, their rules writers or anything like that. It's all just under the company umbrella. And I mean, as far as I know, the kind of last personality at the company, if you like, was the boy Duncan Rhodes, the painter. But apart from that, I don't know if people know too much about the folks at Games Workshop. Again, I could be wrong, but it makes you wonder that, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years, will you be able to go to events and have these people that you know are, you know, real legends in the industry? Will it just be, you know, YouTubers or influencers or whatever the alternative will be far into the future? Will it be those folks that everyone knows rather than the people that have created the games? And I know that there's a whole world outside the Games Workshop, and we know a lot of great games designers and games creators that aren't under that umbrella, but you can't deny they're obviously a massive company. So it will be, I mean, the landscape presumably will change decades from now.
I think it will. I think the comment you make about the influencers thing is a big thing, because I mean, commercially, the amount of companies now that use influencers as essentially their spokespeople, and they just exist as this kind of bland corporate entity behind it, and the voice actually is coming through what, you know, sort of as if it's their customers, but they're obviously actually really their sales agents. It's quite a weird kind of way of doing things. It's possibly not totally sustainable, and people will maybe get a bit burnt out by it, or they'll start to distrust it, or the more professionalized that social media becomes, the closer it becomes to standard media. And so that kind of thing, it starts becoming a bit more like, well, they are the institutions themselves. So I think that might change in its own right. But I think the observation about the fact that you don't know the people who are creating the games, you're more likely to know the people who talk about the games. That's quite an interesting change actually. And I think it's a really good point, because even the fact that I knew who Ali Morrison was, because I recognized him, and I know he sculpted the giant, it is all just information that was at the forefront of what they were doing in White Dwarf. You know, if you looked at those back pages with the pictures and the miniatures, it always said who sculpted them. If there was photographs throughout the magazine, it would always, a battle report or whatever, or an article, it would always have a photo of the person. And it just seems like in a media rich world now, GW would have a perfect opportunity to highlight their creators and really make a big deal of it, but they've obviously chosen not to. And I might actually have a bit of I think it will have a long-term effect in terms of that, because who are the next generation going to come through, and will they be invisible? And will people want to be games designers? You know, is it still as appealing as a job as it was? Because in a growth industry, it should be more appealing. But I don't know. Yeah, it's a really good point.
We won't have to worry about it. Of course, we'll be dead. So
exactly. Just buried with all our metal toys in our coffins.
Yeah, exactly. What else did you get up to at Partizan? Anything else that jumped out at you, or get the opportunity to play or buy anything or that?
So I didn't play anything. I was having a really good chat. There's a guy called James Morris, and he runs a blog called Mogsy Makes, and he's a bit of a prolific blogger, and you know, he's involved in a bit of everything in wargaming as far as I know. And his stuff is kind of out there, and he does amazing conversions, and you know, he's a great painter and he writes rules and all this kind of stuff. So he's kind of, you know, he's a bit of a Renaissance man. He can do it all. And I was chatting to him. He's got a rule set called Midgard, and it's going to be published by the publishing wing of Two Fat Lardies Games. So it's not sort of officially one of their games as such. It's just, you know, being published through their publications branch. And it's a heroic fantasy rule set with a real emphasis on the heroic. So you have leaders for all of your units, and the leaders have heroic points, and then they can kind of use those to create activation points, and you can reserve them, you can keep them back, you can kind of use them as like fate points if you're not sure if something's going to work, or you can top load them to make things happen more reliably and all this kind of stuff. So it sounds like a really cool rule system, actually. And he got this big it was like a Lord of the Rings style game. Well, it wasn't, it was I think the Silmarillion, which is the, I don't really know much about it, but it's the stuff that was, you know, predates like the early years of that Middle Earth. And he'd got these two armies, and it was like an elves army, and then there was kind of orc army, but with led by this dragon, which was pretty cool, and it's got an amazing terrain. And that was really interesting to hear him talk about it, partly because he was talking about the kind of design process, and it was similar to your chat that you had with Mike Hutchinson the other day, when he was saying, you know, when he wanted to create Hobgoblin, he was very acknowledging of the fact that he's releasing a mass battle fantasy game into a market of, you know, there already are lots of mass battle fantasy games that you can choose and play. So what was his design brief? What did he want to create? And like when Mike wanted to make it brutally fast, then James Morris was saying he wanted to make it, you know, feel very heroic, you know. Basically, the soldiers are not going to be interested in fighting this battle. They're not professional soldiers. They'll turn and flee. So it's up to the leaders to kind of keep rallying the troops and keep everyone on the table and keep them kind of, it's all about that heroic leadership thing. I thought that's really cool because it's a different perspective. And that was really good to talk to him about that, even just for sort of 10 minutes. But it's just that, just zooming in on a bit of a design process. Yeah, I found it really interesting. It makes you realize what it is that you do like about certain games, which is, again, sort of coming back to another podcast that was reflected in your May Question of the Month one, where people talking about house rules. Not only was it inspiring to hear about people's house rules, but it's also inspiring to hear about why they want that house rule. What do they want their game to do more of or less of? Do they want it to be quicker or more narrative or this or that? So that was cool at Partisan, just to be able to go around and kind of not grill people, but just find out a little bit more about that, and asking a lot of people about how they've done certain terrain things where, you know, it looks brilliant, but how did you actually create it? And people are very willing to give their time and tell you how they've done things and share in the enthusiasm. And yeah, it's a really nice experience and a really good opportunity to maybe ask questions about something that ordinarily you probably would pass by and go, oh, that's probably not something I'm going to do, or that's not for me. But actually, you know, every game there is born out of enthusiasm and it's born out of passion, and, you know, everything that people are doing, they're all doing it for fun. There's no one there who's kind of, who's difficult to talk to or is going to tell you to go away. They're all very welcoming.
Did you know that, just like every other podcast out there, this show has its very own Patreon? But this is no ordinary Patreon. It's actually the worst Patreon ever. That's right, there's no rewards, no extras, no bonus content, no early access, no shoutouts, and no thank yous. I'll just take the money and quietly get on with making the show. Not that there's any money to take, because hardly anyone's pledging to the thing. Like I say, it's the worst Patreon ever. Find it at bedroombattlefields.com/worstpatreonever. That's all one word, worst Patreon ever. Now, back to the show. What games are kind of in your orbit then at the moment? Like, not necessarily stuff you've got, but stuff you're, you know, that's piqued your interest that you might be looking to dive in the future?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think rules-wise, I'm not sure. I think I feel like I'm at the point where probably I've got a number of rule systems that I think are good. I've got some that I feel more comfortable with in terms of my basic knowledge of it. And I'm probably actually really getting more interested, as I think you are, in more the scenario side of things. I mean, I've always liked scenarios, but I think I'm I feel like the as I've I'm kind of like about probably coming up to 6 years back into the hobby really now, and if I'm thinking, well, if I in 15 years time I still want to be doing this, then where will I go with it? You know, it's not just a case of buying more games or buying more miniatures. I think it's a case of sort of deepening what I do and getting a little bit more, you know, thinking about playing out more kind of campaigns and more structured scenarios and more sort of maybe things with like a sort of GM type elements or big games, multiplayer games. So it's more that kind of using the tools that I've already got through the rules and the miniatures and the terrain and trying to use them to sort of tell more different stories and thinking about that a bit more. I mean, the one thing that I am currently doing as well is I decided after playing, after we had our big Warhammer Games Day in April, it kind of inspired me to actually, you know, that was the first time I played Warhammer in 30 years. And it actually made me go, do you know what? I do like it. It is good. Yes, it's a slower system, and yes, it's different to modern systems, but it's got some real richness to it. And that richness is really exciting and really cool in terms of thinking about what kind of armies you can play and so on. So I've decided, so I've been buying up some new castings of old sculpts, old Grenadier, Wood Elves, and various other things, mixing in some other models from various ranges to try and create a bit of an old school Wood Elf army on 20mm square bases. So it's kind of all, you know, Warhammer compliant, if you like. And I'm interested in getting into that. I'm not looking at the old world. I'm not looking at any specific major particular version. I'll happily pay, whether it's fourth, fifth, sixth edition, doesn't really matter, or third edition. I'll try them all. It's just more having the tools to be able to do it. So I think that's where I'm at really at the moment. Rather than thinking about what's new, more about what have I got and how can I get deeper into it.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, that was another thing to catch up on, was that massive game of Warhammer. We did publish the report that you guys put together on the website with photos and stuff like that. You had a good chat with Josh as well on the Crown of Command about that, which I'll link to in the show notes. Speaking of Josh as well, like how's the painting lessons going? Are you still doing those?
Yeah, really good. I'm sure Josh won't mind me saying, but his son got involved in an accident a couple of weeks ago and is on the mend, thankfully. But as a result, my last painting lesson has been postponed, so that's going to happen later this month. But yeah, I've been having a monthly lesson with him since February, something like that. And it's, yeah, that's really useful, actually. I find it's a really good opportunity just to take something that I've looked at and gone, well, I'm not really quite sure how to do it, so I don't think I will. So try and take those miniatures that I bought and then put on one side because I'm nervous to paint them, and try and flip that round and go, okay, I shouldn't be nervous to paint anything that I've bought, because why did I buy it? I bought it to paint it. I should feel confident enough that I can paint it, you know, to a level that I'm happy with. So that's been kind of what's really driving it. It's like trying to take a certain thing and go, okay, I want to do it like this, but I don't know how. And then really build that as a bit of a brief for Josh on a monthly basis. So he then will look at it and then go, okay, I think this, you do it this way or that way. And some of it's through direct experience of that technique. And some of it's more, he then will go away and research it and think, okay, well, how could that work best? And then come up with a few different solutions. So yeah, it's been really useful. It's also really nice to do. It's a really kind of pleasant hour just to spend, just taking that time and talking and painting and just really focusing in on how someone who's really skilled at something. It's always pleasurable, isn't it, to watch people who are good craftspeople doing their craft. And I certainly have enjoyed that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of your photos recently, and it looks like you're, I mean, I liked your painting anyway, but it's really coming on now. So,
That's cool.
Do you think you'll get to the stage where you look all the stuff that you've done in the past 5 years and you're like, right, time to strip the whole lot and start again? That's always my worry if I was to make some sort of qualitative leap.
It crossed my mind. And actually, the other day, so a couple of weeks ago, was it Jason put something on their Discord saying, well, would you post like with all his progress for like 5 years in the hobby and some things he'd done. It was really cool. And he's like, oh, well, other people post their pictures. And so all my miniatures are in boxes and they're just on the kind of, we've got this weird, like, it's like not a loft, but it's like a mezzanine floor thing in a old house. And I brought them down from there, which is where they're all out. And I laid them all out and just took them out of the boxes and put them on a mat, took a photo of them. And when I was looking at the ones that I painted, sort of the earliest, yeah, they're not as good, but they're fine. And actually, I think it would be really hard to go back and do them. I think it would feel like work, and it would feel like something you were doing for some kind of fairly odd goal. You know, like, well, how much better could you make them? Even 10, 20% better or 50% better. So they're all right. And I think that, yeah, I'm tempted just to leave it and just kind of keep it as a nice record of the progress. It's also quite nice to be able to hold up two miniatures and hold them next to each other and sort of go, oh, well, that one is better than that. So I am improving. So it's that bit of a record of how you're going on, rather than being in sort of erasing the record and being constantly in the present. It's quite nice to have that historic record of where you've come from and how you're developing.
Yeah, I think that's the right attitude to have, because otherwise you're just in an endless, I mean, you're always going to improve if you do it. So you would just be perpetually stripping and repainting. You would get nowhere.
Just a fourth bridge.
Yeah, kind of exactly. Yeah. So the big game of Warhammer, it obviously looked brilliant. What I'm particularly interested in from a mundane point of view is, like, how long did it take to tidy it all up at the end of the day?
It did take quite a long time. Yeah, it did. So I'm trying to think, like, I reckon, so yeah, I think that we started, like, Jason arrived, I walked down there, we met him, and then we started unloading, and then the other guys came and we were putting all stuff out on the table. That was probably an hour, like, setting up, and then it was probably pushing an hour and a half packing away. So it was quite a lot of time. And probably not helped by the fact that, like, we were all me and Ed and Luke were, like, loading stuff into the boxes. And then we ran out of, like, boxes. And there was still, like, half of the miniatures left on the table. It's like, oh, okay. So, yeah, like, packing it all away neatly so it all kind of goes. It's a lot quicker to take them out of the box and put them back in, basically. But, yeah, that was quite a slow part of it. And I think, you know, and that was bearing in mind everything was on movement trays or pretty much everything. So, yeah, it was a lot of stuff. I mean, the amount of stuff that was brought up was pretty overwhelming, really, just in terms of the sheer quantity. And that, not just miniatures, just some of the terrain is massive. You know, Jason's got the homemade trees that are like over a foot tall kind of thing. So yeah, it was really cool, but yeah, quite a lot of work. But at the same time, it was actually really nice, just because it was kind of just a chance to chat and pack it away and look at everything and stuff like that. It was a really nice part of it. We still got hours and hours of gaming in, really. So it well worth it. But yeah, not for the faint-hearted.
Aye, no, I mean, like you're saying, the actual dice rolling is a big part of it, but it's not all of it, is it? Like, there's so many other components to that. And a game like that, you know, it's not your run-of-the-mill Monday night club night game. It's more of an FA Cup final, isn't it? It's a big event. Did you have the suit and tie and the flower in your jacket?
And your head, massive headphones.
Yeah, aye.
Yeah, just to ruin the image. Yeah, it was like that. It was cool. I think the other thing that was really, like, you know, you've talked about this before, just lining all the miniatures up and just looking at them and just putting them out as if they're fighting. Mm-hmm. Like, that is fun, actually, isn't it? And so an element of packing, putting out and packing away was still just joyous, because you're just there just going, oh, wow, look at this. Oh, what's this? Look at this hill. Look at this tree. Look at this house. Look at this monster. You know, so, yeah, really, really. Because that's what's so ace about the hobby. It's, whereas I think if you're, like, some of these modern board games you get now have got, like, you know, they take an hour to set up and it's just pieces of cardboard or little chips or tokens. That, I think, would be heavy going. That would feel like admin. Whereas this, yeah, this doesn't. It feels like it feels like a game in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going back 30 years now, but thinking to when I was young and playing, in quotation marks, playing Warhammer, I think the peak of the experience was often in the setup at that age, just getting all the units out, setting them up, setting the terrain up, and then there's this moment where you look at it and, you know, think, here's a game of Warhammer, you know, most of the miniatures are unpainted, etc., etc. But it seemed like that was almost the peak of the experience, and then being a kid and short attention spans and all that, you maybe get a turn or two and then you end up going out to play football. But I always kind of remember the satisfaction of just, like you're saying, just lining both the armies up and getting ready to go.
Yeah, I think there's a big part of that. I mean, if you think about the kind of stuff, the toys that are still really popular with kids and always will be, you know, you've got things like Lego and Playmobil, and a lot of it is just about setting up these dioramas and making these scenes, isn't it? And stuff like that, and just seeing it all there in front of your eyes. I remember doing that with like everyone brought their Scale X-Trix track around to someone's garden. You know, like we've got about 10 people's kits and just set up this massive track and then plugged it in and it didn't work because it was done it wrong or whatever. But the power adapter wasn't powerful enough to do, like, you know, 8 miles of track or whatever. But it's just the experience of setting things up and laying things out, making these Rob in our Discord put something, Rob Dean, he put a post on, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like a link to a psychological study about this idea of just creating these little worlds and that being like a really massive part of play for kids, like playing with dolls, playing with toys, playing with little figurines and creating these spaces. And I don't think it's wrong. I think it does appeal to everyone.
Yeah, I've really noticed with my daughter the past maybe even past year now. She's coming on 3, but she's got really into like little figures. She's got like little Peter Rabbit figures and stuff like that. You know, they I call them Transylvanian families to try and wind her up, but she doesn't get the joke, so she just calls them that too. I think they're called Sylvanian families, but she'll just sometimes go and play for like an hour just herself, and it's moving stuff around and doing the voices and stuff like that. And it's cool just to watch because you're seeing just pure imagination at play rather than her being spoon-fed from a tablet or a TV show or whatever. You know, it's just her fully engaging with physical things and creating a world and a story in her, you know, small mind. So I think that's really important.
It is, but it's also so significant of how many children need, or not need, but use the toys and the figures to create that. You know, they're not just telling a story. They want the characters and they want to get them to talk to each other and put them in bed and do this stuff and go over here and we're going for a walk. And it just the actual act of using the toy to bring it all to life seems really, really pivotal. So I know that's probably just shows that us playing with war games is we're kind of basically like proto 3-year-olds who haven't actually got out of that, but I can live with that as a trauma.
Just a massive toddler with a beard. Anything else, just as we sort of come to the end of our chat, Mark, anything else hobby related on your mind at the moment, anything you've been up to or any plans, anything like that?
So I suppose the one thing that was worth just calling people's attention to is, depending on when this episode goes out, you either are welcome to or have sorely missed out on the next Royal Orc virtual pub session, which is on Monday the 17th of June, so 11 days from now. Not that that matters to anyone when now is, but that's something that's that people can absolutely hop on board with, get involved, come along. David's written a cool quiz, a 40k theme quiz, so we've got that up our sleeve and some other games to play and just paint and chat and just join in and share with everyone what you've been up to. That'd be really nice.
Aye, please, if you could make it along, that'd be brilliant. I sadly can't make it myself. I'm in Windermere on holiday, going to Peter Excellent. Rabbit. Is it called Peter Rabbit
indeed.
World, Beatrix Potter World, something like that? We were there in Christmas, at Christmas, I should say, last year. And I was kind of, this got nothing to do with the hobby, it just sprung to my mind there, but I was kind of laughing. Have you been to Beatrix Potter World in Windermere?
I don't think so. Well, no, I definitely haven't, in fact. Yeah, no.
Because, I mean, obviously it's like predominantly for kids because it's Peter Rabbit and that, but they were like, they have like, so you go through this, it's like an exhibition and they've got stuffed like Mr. Todd and Jemima Puddle Duck and all this, but it's like a set time of the day that everyone goes into this, or they have sessions. So the first thing is you go into this like wee cinema, they're really keen on you. You've got to watch the video. So like you go in and watch the video and it starts talking about like Beatrix Potter, really pivotal role in like copywriting characters and stuff like that. It's like, but there's all these like kids, like, you know, 3, 2 year olds just sitting watching this like explanation of like copyright history.
A TED talk really. About intellectual property legislation.
Yeah, exactly. Like
in the 19th century.
Yeah. And all these kids, like some kids were literally crying. I don't know if there was a correlation there, but I thought that was quite
funny. Those are kids who have like got, you know, a new Netflix series planned based on
them. Yeah, I've just pitched something, but I don't have the IP. Yeah. So
yeah, it's Paul Rabbit, and he's always in Mr. McGonagall's garden. Yeah.
So when's the Royal Orc then? Monday the 17th.
It is Monday the 17th.
Yeah. Aye, I'll push this episode out before then, and yeah,
please
do make it along to that. I really enjoyed listening along to the last one. I was listening along. I couldn't contribute because the wall between me and the wee lassie's bedroom is quite thin. So
yeah, it's like that in our house. We're basically like wherever you are, if you're talking, then everyone else is listening. And so whenever I've done them here before, like. Yeah, my wife and kids just go, "You're so loud on that thing. What are you laughing about with those stupid friends of yours?"
Yeah. That's on the internet again.
We were joking about how expensive Techless is. I was like, right, okay, brilliant. And there we go, back to the toddler with the beard, I think.
So, yeah, full circle. Massive toddlers with beards. Should rename the podcast that.
Tinder profile.
Cool. Well, we'll obviously get together on the podcast at a future date, and I could tell you all about Beatrix Potter World. We could do a key takeaways episode on that. Yeah,
so Warhammer World versus Beatrix Potter World. Which one's got the more aggressive intellectual property rights?
That is good clickbait. That we'll do a YouTube video. We'll get a thumbnail. Yeah. I'll have a shocked face. And the thumbnail, and we'll
the dirty secret Beatrix Potter doesn't want you to know.
We'll capitalize one of the words in the title and everything. So
yeah, 10 things about this. Number 7 will make your hair stand on end. Something like that.
Going to grow the show's audience by at least 3. So.
Fantastic. Look forward to it.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.